Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is my good buddy and extraordinaire, real estate extraordinaire, right? Real estate professional.
I guess, yeah.
Real estate rock star.
It's great to be on here again, George.
Kenny McElroy.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
If you forget his name, it's
yeah, it's right here.
It's right there. But man, there is so much going on in global macro. There's so much going on with the U.S. real estate market.
Crazy.
And I know residential is a little bit different than multifamily.
Yep.
That's kind of your bread and butter.
Mostly commercial.
Yeah, right now, what's on everyone's mind are interest rates going up. And mortgage rates going from pretty much 3% up to 5.2%, something like that.
Yep.
And are rates going higher? Are they going lower?
Yep.
What are you seeing on your end? Because you deal directly with a lot of these bankers.
We do.
And then what are you seeing with maybe cap rates? Let's just go over all that stuff.
Sure. Happy to do all of that. So as you know, real estate, it doesn't matter if it's residential or commercial or self-storage or whatever it is. The interest rates affect all of it. So
right.
This is a universal issue. It doesn't really matter if you're residential or your office buildings or your multifamily. And so I'm hearing the squeeze from everyone. So things are slowing down. So if we had anything in escrow, let's say for, 3 months ago, which is, in the commercial world, that's pretty common. You tie something up, you do maybe a month of due diligence, you're trying to get all your financing, your debt and equity and all that stuff. And you're figuring all that out as you're proceeding toward close. You're on a commercial deal, you're looking at a 60, 90, even 120 day close on a lot of. So during that time, interest rates went up.
Right.
During that time, cap rates have gone up. So
now, price is down.
Yes. And so if you had something locked, let's say 60 days ago, 90 days ago, and it was based on a cash flow and you hadn't locked your debt yet. And by the way, obviously you can go fixed rate debt or bridge debt or floating debt, obviously are the two options. And so if it's any kind of a value add, it's a floater.
Mm-hmm.
If it's like a coupon, of course you're going to fix because you're just waiting to get that money and over time you're going to be fine. But any kind of a value add, you don't fix your debt because you're going to have these prepayment penalties and yield maintenance and things. So what's happening is a lot of these people that had deals in escrow or do have deals in escrow are now retrading.
Yeah, right.
They're retrading sellers.
Yeah, you told us that story the other day about a deal that you were looking at. I think they're asking 80. And then like 2 weeks later or something, they dropped it down to 70.
They took
10 million off the price.
They did. Yeah. And so what happens is you think about it, it's kind of a feeding frenzy. Low interest rates brought a lot of people into the game. Easy money, bid up prices, and sellers got a bit greedy. And so it was really getting kind of obnoxious. And I've been in this game a long time. So multiple best in finals and kind of being super selective on who. And it was very much like a parade, as they tried to figure out.
The seller's market.
100%. Now what's happened is so the brokers now are slow. They're still trying to get listings. The brokers are kind of slow to respond. And they're still pumping the sellers with these high numbers. But the buyers are now, they're saying, listen, we're not going to pay that because our cash flow is less.
Yeah, what's that saying that the sellers are always looking in the rear view mirror and the buyers are always looking through the windshield?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. No, it's the truth.
But that's why real estate moves so slowly. People always say, well, when's the market going to crash, quote unquote? I said, well, real estate, the prices can go down in nominal terms. They can definitely go down in real terms adjusted for inflation. But rarely does the real estate market, quote unquote, crash.
Yep.
Like even if we go back to 2006, it took 6 years to go from the peak to the trough.
Yep.
So I think people have to recognize that. But it doesn't mean that prices can't go down. And I guess that's what you're seeing with multifamily. Do you think that'll flow over into residential?
I do. And already has started. It's just kind of, there's two things happening on residential because, as you know, we're also in that game a little bit. One is prices have gone up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so it very differently when somebody's trying to get a residential loan, let's say, either to move in themselves or potentially to to, you know, throw an Airbnb or a renter in, they look at the person. They look at their individual credit and all those kinds of things and their assets. On the commercial side, they look at the project.
Right, right.
Because
right.
the project pays back the debt. And so, and they do that, of course, on the residential side. But so as you've had these, affordability has gone way down and prices have gone way up. And now the interest rates have gone up.
Mm.
Those two things have been bad for residential. So it's slowing down
the
market.
Because you've got two equations there. You've got demand and supply. And I think most people get super fixated on one or the other.
Yes.
So if you're bullish, you're always saying, well, supply is low, 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 low. And if you're bearish, you're saying, yeah, but aggregate demand is going to come down because purchasing power goes down. But really, it's just a question of, okay, where is each line and how far is aggregate demand going to go down? And can it go down to a point where nominal prices still come down even with incredibly low supply? Because that's probably a problem that isn't going to be fixed very soon as far as more supply coming online.
That's right. And when you blend the two, it actually really gets interesting. So as an example, one of the things that I always watch for during our tour that we did with the collective in Dallas is I'm looking at what are the home prices, you know, right next door.
Right.
And if home prices were, let's say, 600 2 years ago and now they're 800, 900, all of a sudden that mortgage is higher. But now with interest rates, that mortgage is a lot higher. Mm. So when you compare that with the nominal rent rate, so those are the two things that I look for. So,
as big of a delta as possible.
Yes. And the thing is because prices are high on residential and interest rates, you're talking about a lot more on the payment. If you look at the two with rent growth, a lot of focus is on rent growth, and that has been kind of out of control in a lot of markets. But now let's take a look at the mortgage payment growth. And so if you look at that, you can see that affordability is becoming a real problem. It's actually pushing people back into rentals.
Yeah, and why you like to get those apartment complexes in those really, really good neighborhoods with single family is because those people, if they can't afford that house, they still want to send their kid to that school.
That's right. That's exactly what, when we went to that project in Plano, Texas, 2 weeks ago with our collective group, that's exactly what we were trying to do. Is the Plano school district is one of the top rated ones in the in Texas. And the homes in the area are $1 million plus. And so the rents are $1,500, $1,600. So people move there so they can raise a family there and their kids can go to a great public school.
Yeah, that's right. And talk to us about your strategy that you've been very successful with, where you don't really go in and buy these A properties, apartment complexes. You kind of like the B.
Yeah.
Or the B plus.
Yeah, I do.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, one reason is because if we do go into a recession where people have a harder time paying the rent, people are kind of going to go down the economic totem pole. But if you start at the top and people have to go down that totem pole, those rental units at the top are going to go vacant.
That's
right. But the ones at the bottom still have those people from the upper level coming back down to them.
So, right. So as we head into this recession or stagflation or whatever you want to call it, people start to look at canceling their gym memberships. You know, how do I save as the landlords are increasing 200, 300, 400, let's say at the end of their leases, they start to adjust. And that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so to your point, if they're in an A class community and I have a B class community in the same zip code, let's say, that's maybe 20 or 30 years older, but it's still very well maintained. New appliances, new countertops, but they can save $300 or $400 or $500 a month. That's why I think it's best to be in that middle tier.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. You know, a question that I asked this gentleman by the name of Alfonso, he goes by Macro Alf on Twitter. He used to run a $20 billion fund.
Oh, wow.
Now a bond fund. And so I asked him the specific question, what do you think it would take to get Blackstone to sell a lot of those single family homes that they either own or they own shares in an entity that owns a lot of these? What was the company called? It was
Invitation Homes.
Yeah. So I think they might have sold their shares, but they indirectly own a lot of these single family homes. So I'm trying to think of the supply side. We know that there's not going to be a lot of these starter homes built because you just can't build them at a profit, but it doesn't mean there's not going to be a lot sold. So if you've got Invitation Homes, as an example, owning 80,000 of these rental properties, from a standpoint of the fund managers themselves, what would prompt them to sell? And one thing we discussed is interest rates, like on the 10-year, going up to 5 or 6%, so they have an alternative that's superior risk-reward. But the other thing he said that I thought was interesting, I think you'd have some insight, he said if your investors, especially the big investors, start pressuring you to sell because they think prices are going to go down in the future, you've got to sell.
Right.
You get a lot of pressure from your investors. So do you have any insight there?
Well, it's interesting because yesterday I was looking at an apartment deal that's owned by Blackstone that just hit the market in Austin. I've been around this business long enough to see how some of the institutions handle themselves. You know, I'm going back to Equity Residential. We're talking about Lehman Brothers. You know, I've done stuff with them, and a lot of these groups. You know, when they buy these bulks, they I think they were moving out of cash into hard assets. First of all,
right,
and also cash flowing hard assets.
Yeah.
Then what happens is their actual fund, the return, you know, the FFO, that's funds from operations, it's low because there's not, you know, if they buy, let's say, Invitation Homes, it's really a put almost. You know, they have to be churning in order to reap the profits because there's not enough cash flow to pay out. So really,
or it's call option that they're betting on the price. That price, they have to have the price appreciation.
Correct.
It's not just the cash flow.
Yes. Right. Yeah. So a lot of these deals are low on cash flow, high on appreciation.
Right. Okay.
And so you're going to have a bit of churn on the money, and I think also some of it has to do with new money in, as you know. But the old money, to your point, is going to drive largely the hold period.
Yeah. So what do you think it would take to get their investors to call them on the phone and say, sell those starter homes that you own?
Well, I think that it depends on the terms, of course, of the equity. Equity does drive a lot of things. So let's just be clear. So if one of their largest investors came in and said, you know, we need you to do this, I think that there will probably have to be a reason why. In other words, they need the money for something else, you know. But usually that money has a 3 to 4 year window on it. So on all the institutional deals that I've had, so IRR, or internal rates of return, go down the longer you hold something, right? There is a bit of churn in that money. There's a 3 to 4 year period. So typically, you might have that money 3 years, 4 years, with maybe some couple 1 year, true ups.
Yeah.
So maybe 5 years at the most. Mm-hmm. So when you take on that equity, you're beholden to that equity.
Yeah, until that time is up.
Correct.
And then you get some of the old investors that stay, and some new investors hopefully come on to fill the gap or add to the overall fund.
That's
so
right.
It really depends on what the environment is at that specific time.
And there's one other complexity that a lot of people might not understand, and that is when you take on that money, let's say you give me $100 million to go invest. There's an agreement around that, obviously. So there's hurdles on the IRRs or the returns. So let's say it might start at 8 or 9%, and at that point there's what's called a waterfall, a certain split, more to you, less to me.
All right.
And then as the IRR goes up, you know, so let's say it goes to 12 or 14 or 16, let's say, then all of a sudden our splits get trued up. So the equity might be saying, hey, you know, let's sell now because our IRRs are there, because now my split's going to be higher. And you're going to go, well, you know, I'd rather hold. But if you hold, you potentially, the IRRs can dwindle down again.
Right, right.
So there's a waterfall around the money that gets lent.
Yeah, so the bottom line here is it's complicated.
Yeah.
And there are things that are happening behind the scenes.
A lot.
That could... let's say adjust the supply demand dynamics within residential real estate that are maybe atypical Because usually that would be driven by supply or by demand from homeowners.
Correct.
Or maybe small investors like myself. But now we're in this weird environment where a lot of the price that's set on the margin is determined by these huge, huge funds
yep.
that are making decisions based on different metrics
a lot of
than
different.
Just some guy wanting to buy a house because he wants his kid to go to that school.
That's right. And I think the big lesson for everyone who's, you know, people complain about, you know, Blackstone being in the market and all these big companies entering, and it is an issue, and they are gobbling up, and I think it's because they're moving out of cash. But I'll tell you, just from being in the business a long time, none of these groups are long-term hold.
Right, right, right.
Not
right,
any
right.
of them.
Right, right.
So, you know, which means inventory mm-hmm. at higher numbers, because the only way to pay back investors is to sell.
Yeah, right. What are you seeing, or what are you doing in your own business in regards to shortages and potential future inflation?
So on the shortage side, it's super concerning. So just to give you a couple numbers, we have 50 million in renovations.
Mm-hmm.
That's renovations. So that's a kitchen might be, you know, 15 grand. An apartment might be 15 grand. That's flooring, appliances, those kinds of things. So we have 50 million just in our company in that category. Then we have 6 ground up construction projects.
Right. On top of that, they
and
need
another
supplies
category.
For.
Yeah. So we have existing inventory that we're converting, like the one that we saw in Dallas. And then we have ground up construction. Both are very concerning.
Yeah. And I remember, I don't want to cut you off, yep. but I remember a story your GC guy told us at that one complex you have, where we noticed the flooring was the same on a couple units, and ideally you wanted to change the flooring, and we asked why, and he said, well, we just couldn't get it. So we had no other choice but yeah. to use this yeah. This flooring that was maybe a plan B instead of what was optimal.
There's a lot of that happening all over the place, and I was talking to a big custom home builder yesterday, and he said he was driving around, and there's sites that don't even have people on them.
Hmm.
And so you've got some labor issues too, and then you have some supply chain issues too. And so it's happening in all categories. It's happening in the custom homes. It's also happening in the regular home builder, you know, what would be now called, you know, entry level homes. It's happening in apartments. And so for us, you know, my partner Ross and I, you know, we're looking at 10%+ busts, 10-15% busts. So just to put that in perspective, if you've got a $40 million, let's say 250 unit apartment complex, you're looking at a $3-5 million bust.
Okay. That's the budget basically
yeah.
to renovate the specific. Oh, to build from scratch?
To build from scratch. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
On the reno side, you know, to your point, we can't get washers and dryers. We can't get microwaves.
So are you? So when you can get them, are you buying more than you actually need?
We're buying as many as we can get,
right?
And trying to store them, yeah, because we have so many going. So we're doing one project, just one in San Antonio, 680 units. Mm. I need 680 washers and dryers,
right?
680 refrigerators, 680 sinks. You know, and so you start to look at those kinds of things. Flooring, all of that stuff, and then it's just a mess, and so we have to adjust. You know,
you seen that get any better over the last year?
It's worse.
It's been getting worse.
Yeah, and I think so, because what's happening is people that, let's say, to your point, if I'm moving along and I'm trying to get, let's say, a stainless appliances, I can get 200 of them, mm. and I can't get them, I'm going to go to black. I'm going to take all that. And then I'm going to go, you know, you're basically trying to finish your project. And so you have to adjust. And so you're now robbing, I guess is probably not a great word, but from other types of things that you would be doing just to finish.
Mm.
And so normally you would have a very standardized list of things. And because you don't, now you're maybe going to all kinds of sources just to finish the project.
Yeah, you're just having to piece yes. it all together. With whatever you
and
can
that
get.
Hurts everybody.
Yeah, and that reduces the supply yes. downstream. Yeah, so it's interesting because usually in a free market, these problems would be fixed
yeah.
pretty quick. You know, the price goes up or you see a massive shortage, and that's an opportunity for an entrepreneur or a business to supply that and pick up some serious profit that increases the margin. Therefore, you know, you get competition in there to fill it. But we're just seeing it get worse and worse and worse, which leads me to believe that maybe we're in an environment where the cure for high prices is not high prices like it usually would be, you know, because these supply chains maybe have been, I don't want to say permanently damaged, but they've been damaged to a point where they can't get fixed in the next 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 years because of the hit they took during the lockdowns or, you know, during 2020 and 2021.
Yeah, I personally don't see it getting any better anytime soon. You know, most, if you look at almost everything that we're buying, and I'm talking about flooring, I'm talking about countertops, I'm talking about faucet fixtures and appliances and almost every and light fixtures, anything that you might see or touch is almost all outside of the United States.
Yeah, right.
In one way or another.
Right. Well, yeah, that's probably where our trade deficit is at all-time highs. But so do you have any idea as to why it's so hard to find employees? This is something that I've struggled with, right? Like we hear on the news all the time that the labor force participation is extremely low, which kind of artificially makes the unemployment number, the headline number, low. But I always scratch my head and I say, how? Like how can these people be in a position to where they can decide whether or not they want to go back to work? Like, okay, I get it. You got stimulus checks.
Yeah.
You got PPP. But, you know, cryptocurrency is used to, you know, we could say that it tripled. Now it's, you know, halved again. But I understand that. But for the masses, you know, how is it possible that all these coffee shops, all these retailers, all these construction sites, and probably your business as well, can't find the employees that you need? I mean, what on earth are they doing? How can they afford to not go back to work?
I wish I knew. I got to tell you, we hired a full-time employee recruiter about a year ago.
Really?
Full-time.
Because you're having such a difficulty.
And, you know, she's a 100-plus a year salaried.
Right.
And just to go out and find job at job fairs and to go out and look for people on LinkedIn and whatever we can do to drive people. We have about 300 people at our company.
Is she telling you why it's been so hard? Like, and what are people, are they saying, no, we don't want the job because?
So it's really been an interesting time. I've been all over this issue every week. I think we have, at any given time right now, we were in the 30s. I think we're in the 40s of open positions. And, this is something that we monitor every week. So I know exactly where we are. I don't know all the positions specifically, but I know the number because I want to see this metric. Am I going up? Am I going down? And so after hiring her, we really haven't had much of a dent. And by the way, this girl's fantastic.
Mm.
So it's not her. And we'll find people. They'll come in and, you know, there's a vetting process, right? You interview them, you get them through, you onboard them. And sometimes they just don't stick around. Sometimes there's so much competition for people. We find that once they start, that somebody makes them a better offer and they leave.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a bit of that. I think that it's a result of the amount of savings. If you look, it's way up.
Right.
It's at an all-time high. And I think that people that probably they just don't think that there's ever going to be a problem. And they were so tight before. Now there's a little bit of cushion and, you know, they're out doing whatever they're doing and they like also the work from home piece. They like the flexibility that they've had. And so they're kind of looking for that, you know, the options to be able to be work from home, get a high pay and maybe not so hard.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think a lot of the aggregate demand in the United States is a result of high asset prices or asset bubbles.
Yeah.
And so my concern is that if these asset prices come down, which the Fed is trying to do to bring down the headline CPI, that's going to reduce the purchasing power. We go from a labor shortage very, very quickly to a labor surplus because those people draw down their savings and there's no more stimmy checks. You know, cryptocurrency isn't at all-time highs or whatever to where they say they find themselves in a position where they wake up and like, okay, got to go back to work. And then that happens all at the same time.
I hope so. I got to be honest. You know, it's interesting, but then I see like L.A. County come up with a UBI, and then I see Austin come up with a UBI, or, you know, Universal Basic Income. They're testing it, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so they're – I don't know where all that's going to go, but I think as long as I've seen it – like, I'm a big fan of welfare and Section 8 and all that kind of stuff, because I think people do need a hand from time to time, and I love these social programs. They're, you know, I've seen firsthand where people – that, you know, there's medical issues or divorce issues or something happens and they're, you know, they're going through a rough patch. And those systems are supposed to, you know, help people.
Yeah, the social safety
absolutely.
Net.
Mm-hmm. What's happened, though, is I've also seen the other side of it, and that is when they get, you know, entitled to it. And then it doesn't make them have any kind of they don't aspire to have anything beyond that. So I think we're kind of navigating through this period of time. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and then the politicians see that as a way to buy votes.
Yeah.
And then that just exacerbates the problem. Correct. Because what we're seeing now is a lot of these politicians, and I just saw the UK come out today and say that they're doing a windfall tax on the oil companies to give the average Joe and Jane more money so they could afford the higher gas prices. And you're like, whoa, timeout, guys, timeout. Let's go back a bit and figure out why we have high consumer prices.
Yep.
It's because we don't have enough stuff. It's not because we don't have enough money.
Correct.
Right? So we got to focus on producing more stuff. And everything that the central planners and the government is doing is increasing the currency unit supply and decreasing the amount of stuff we have access to, which of course their solution is going to exacerbate the problem like it usually does.
Same thing in the U.S. I mean, we cut off some pipeline and then we put price controls over gas.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're going to cut down on the supply and then limit it. But they're doing the same thing with rent. So, you know, they're saying we're going to do rent control in areas or some kind of a rent cap. Which I get, like, because, you know, and I'm in the business there, you know, rents are out of control and it's a supply issue.
Yeah.
And
but I mean, you'd be a perfect person to kind of get the lowdown on what really happens with rent control, you know, and we've heard, you know, economists like Thomas Sowell and Milton Friedman say, you know, this looks good on at surface level, but at the end, it really hurts the people that you're trying to help. So if we come to one of your properties, let's say tomorrow, and say, okay, Kenny, we're doing rent control. You're at $1,500 right now. For the next 10 years, you can't raise rents. What are, as the owner of that property, assuming you can't sell it, what are you going to do or not do as a result of that rent cap?
Well, what happens is you can't fix all the other costs.
There you go.
Yeah. So, you know, utilities have gone up. Payroll, we all just talked about that, has gone up. You know, property taxes are going up, have gone up. Insurance has gone up. Like, so people that are getting hit with these inflationary issues, they're, you know, that service all these properties, their stuff's gone up. The appliances have gone up. So you, if you fix one thing, then it hurts because all of a sudden, you know, eventually that could drive the whole project into the ground from a
maintenance standpoint. That's the only thing that can give if you can't increase your prices along with the prices that you're having to pay. So if you can't, you know, if you can't increase your rent while your input costs are increasing, the only release valve there is the maintenance.
Correct.
So the property just continues to deteriorate and deteriorate and deteriorate.
Right, right. It's, trust me, at that point, it has nothing to do with the landlord taking profits. Mm-hmm. It has only to do with the landlord trying to keep the property.
Yeah, and then so we thought through it from a standpoint of existing supply, but what happens to future supply if rent controls are in place?
So that's happening already. So what's happening is, I'm in the space. I'm talking to lenders all the time. We closed on a deal 2 days ago, another $58 million deal, and so I'm talking to this debt and these debt and equity markets all the time.
Right, right.
And I won't name the name, but one very big company out of San Francisco said, we're not even looking at the coasts. So he's like, we're not even, you know, basically was saying Washington, Oregon, and California.
Right,
we're
right.
not even going there. This is a very big company, like one of the biggest in the world. And he was specifically called out St. Paul, Minnesota. He said they did a rent cap.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, so money goes where it's treated best.
Right.
So they're funding, they're not funding New York. They're going to North Carolina, they're going to Florida, they're going to Texas, they're going to Arizona. So, and because, you know, they, why would I fund somebody in a market where they're capping their income?
Yeah, and they're going to have a tougher time paying back the loan.
Correct. So the financial markets have already figured this out and they're way ahead of everybody.
Right. Right.
They're like, you know, because again, they want their money back. And so if the state or city or county is capping the income and they're jacking the property taxes and all your input costs and all the other stuff. And of course,
interest rates are going up.
Yeah. They're like, you know, they're being super selective on where to go. And
yeah,
so
right.
what's also happening is the loan to value is going down. The debt coverages that they look at are getting harder and harder and harder. And they're also creating reserves now.
Mm.
So they're saying, we think interest rates might go up. So we want you to put up an interest rate reserve as part of your deal.
Mm.
And they also want us to put a renovation reserve as part of our deal. The lenders are getting involved in, you know, hedging.
Or forcing you to hedge.
Well, yeah, it's our money, right? or less of proceeds, I guess. But they're saying we need you to stick your money into these buckets because we're not sure where interest rates are going to go. We're not sure where your renovation costs are going to go, and it's prudent thinking,
mm-hmm.
you know, because not thinking that way is what kind of hurt the markets back
right.
in 08, 9, 10. So it's good thinking, and they're putting back on the borrow, which is exactly what should happen. But you know, it's going to affect future investment for sure.
It means lower supply.
Yeah.
So if you think we've got low supply right now, there's going to be less of it
yeah.
coming online, the more uncertainty we have and the more the central planners try to plan, that we have more and more uncertainty, which means less investment and then less supply. And that means prices go up,
yeah.
which again, it goes right back to these good intentions. What is it? The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, and that's what rent control is.
It is. You know, I'll tell you, one of the really cool indicators that your listeners can follow is the home ownership versus rental ownership. So under the Bush administration, cause he was like, everyone needs to rent a house or buy a house. It started to go up, and he's like, and we got all the way up to like 68-69% home ownership in the United States. And then, the next administration, Obama, I think he kind of took it. It wasn't really his doing, but that's when it started to unravel.
Mm-hmm.
And so as that starts ticking down from 68, 67, 66, 65, every 1% is like a million people moving from home ownership to rentals.
Mm.
This is really important.
Right, right.
So you're basically taking the people that would be homeowners, moving them over to rentals, creating a lot of demand over here. At the same time, with the lower home ownership, we've seen these prices go up. So that's another thing. So I believe for the first time in our nation's history, we're actually going to get into the 50s. Of home ownership versus rentals. And I think we're heading toward a renter nation, very much like, well, you travel the world, you see in Italy, you see in Europe, you see in Australia, you know, where home prices, like there are people that will never actually be
yeah.
able to buy a home.
And you get more people per square foot.
Correct. Yeah. So yeah. I think that's where we're heading based on all the factors that I see before us.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, Kenny. Well, as always, some yeah. incredible information there. Just value bombs right and left.
Yeah.
You're delivering the goods today.
I know, man, I tell you.
Now, you're going to be at Rebel Capital's live speaking.
Oh, I can't wait. Yes.
And I'm going to be speaking at your Limitless event
yes.
here in a couple weeks.
Yep.
So you're going to be there with Kiyosaki, with Doug Casey, with Chris Martinson, with our good buddy Jason Hartman, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, Brent Johnson, Jeff Snyder, Joseph Wang, just name a few. So you guys can get your tickets at RebelCapitalsLive.com.
Yep.
But for my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Yeah, so they can go to kenmcelroy.com, and you can kind of see all the stuff we have going on. We have our Limitless event, which is pretty darn close to being sold out, but it's next week, 2 weeks from now in Scottsdale, June 9th, 10th, 11th. And you can find everything there for sure. But
talk about your YouTube channel.
The YouTube channel. Right? That's right. Yeah, the YouTube channel's been great. We do a live on Mondays, a podcast on Wednesday, and then a learning on Friday. And that's actually been so much fun.
It is. Isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And I can't wait to go to Rebel Capitalist. I went last year. It's pretty impressive, the people that are showing up trying to educate people.
Yeah, you always learn something, and it's great to hang out with like-minded individuals.
I know.
You know, your fellow rebel capitalists.
I got to be honest. I sat through all that stuff, and I kind of followed it. When Jeff Snyder got up there, man, I was like, okay, I'm lost.
Yeah, what's funny is Kiyosaki's always in the front row, like, taking notes.
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing, is so is everyone else. It's really, really good information, and I tell you what, something they should not miss, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right, buddy. Enjoy your day, man.
Cheers.
Thanks.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Do you enjoy watching these interviews I do for the Rebel Capitalist show? Well, if so, you would absolutely love Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the conference I do twice per year, and we've had speakers like Robert Kiyosaki, Lynn Alden, Rick Rule, Jeff Snyder, and Dr. Ron Paul, just to name a few. So go to RebelCapitalistLive.com and check out the next event we have scheduled in Miami. Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.